Take the time, because the submitter after you has given up their space, so you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Yes, this was 1.5 days, I think, 4 hours this morning. So, well, thanks very much for that. So, start on page 2. My name is Scott Freeman. At the time I was in this mission 555, I was registered to own the property located on Bride Street, Franklin, Queenstown. I since sold this property, however, I'm now a tenant at this address. I've lived at this address since 2005. I'm currently a committee member of the Franklin Community Association. I was previously involved in a community group referred to as Walker Street Residents Against Aircraft Noise that was involved in the Plan Change 35 proceedings. I'm a Franklin Community Representative on the Queenstown Airport Liaison Committee that was established as a consequence of PC 35 and the associated notice of requirement. Having been on the Airport Liaison Committee for 3 years, I've been directly involved in the finalisation of the Queensland Airport Noise Management Plan and the land covenant, including non injection requirements, which will apply when a QAC retrofits existing qualifying residential dwellings from a noise insulation and mechanical ventilation perspective. Until I sold the property, I had extensive dealings with the QAC in terms of retrofitting of that dwelling. I am a qualified resource management planner, however today my views are not represented on a professional basis. Submission. Submission 555 is clear in its intention, which is the protection of the existing operative district plan with residential development rights for residential properties located within the e-noise boundary that is associated with the Queenstown Airport and also contained within the low density residential zone. This development right affords the ability to develop one residential unit per 450 square metres net at land use stage. Any property over 900 square metres net within the AEMB has a right for two residential dwellings, known as 60 McBride Street, 1012 square in area. Notified Rule 7411 within the PDP seeks to extinguish the right for a second residential dwelling at such properties. Following the notification of the PDP and becoming aware of the existence of Notified Rule 7411, I approached the QAC Policy Planning Department. The response from the QAC was quite candid, and that the Notified Rule 7411 was a mistake. There was no intention of removing the one dwelling per 450 net requirement for properties in the A and B. As a consequence, the QAC and its corporate submission sought to rectify this mistake. At this time, I also approached the QAC in relation to Notified Rule 7411. After some dialogue, the QAC resolved to not support 7411 in the fair maintaining of the district development rights for one dwelling per 450. I also contacted a number of private landowners within the e-noise boundary that would lose development rights should Rule 7411 be eventually confirmed. Such landowners were not thrilled with this prospect, hence the no submissions from such parties. PC35. I had personal involvement in PC35 for a number of years, and one of the main drivers of my involvement in PC35 was to ensure that the existing development rights, i.e. two residential dwellings, to certain land within the A and B would not be removed via this planning process. Through various meetings, both public and private, with QAC staff and consultants, it was confirmed by the QAC that PC35 would not seek to remove such development rights. In this regard, I had the benefit of reading a statement of the evidence compiled by Mr. John Kyle dated the 30th of September 2016 that was prepared on behalf of the QAC. In terms of the background associated with PC35, I agree with the following statement from Mr. Kyle. Enable a future indoor residential development on those sites within the zone capable of accommodating additional residential units subject to meeting the building standards set out above. The minimum site density requirement of one residential unit per 450 and the minimum subdivision development size of 600, which are included in the operative district plan, were not altered in an assessment at the time of PC35 here. The most likely outcome for infill development inside OCB would be relatively low number of additional units under this density subdivision scenario. I note that the New Zealand Standard for Airport Noise Management and Lands Planning, NZS6805-192, promotes an approach whereby all new A stands within an airport, ENB and OCB are prohibited. This approach adopted for the low-density residential zone was a compromise which endeavoured to balance the future needs of the airport and the needs and aspirations of the Franklin residential community. In the end, this approach was widely accepted by the community, and members of the community continue to work closely with the QHC on noise management matters via their representation on the Airport Noise Management Committee. Clearly, PC35 is promulgated on the basis of the existing and operative development rights for land contained within the air noise boundary and maintained. Submission by Barnes. After the submission period for the PDP in late 2015, I spoke with Ms. Katrina Cooper, Legal and Regulatory Counsel for Brands, concerning the implication of the Notified Law 741 and that the QHC informed that its planning provision was a mistake. Ms. Cooper informed me that the view of Barnes was that there should be a limit on residential dwellings next to the airport. Ms. Cooper further outlined that one way to deal with Barnes' concerns was to place a non-objection cover on the effective property owner's certificate of title so as to avoid huge complaints against operations at the airport. I've not dealt with that demand since. But I also might be a statement, an opportunity to take this approach to counsel a genuine mistake in accordance with Notified Rule 7411. Both the QADC and the QAC have accepted this mistake and have acted appropriately in my view. Quite rightly promoted NZS6805 as a means to support Notified Rule 7411. And in the perfect world, there will be no ASANs in close proximity to the airport, or alternatively, Queensland Airport will be relocated to a position where existing ASANs are not compromised. Clearly, the outcome will occur. And it is my understanding that Barnes could have challenged this density issue to the Environment Court via PC35, but did not. Mr. Cole supports the principal decision of Barnes, and Mr. Cole states the following. However, as discussed in paragraph 2.8, QSC adopted a compromised position in promulgating PC35. In my opinion, this approach remains sound in the circumstances, and it should be noted was accepted by the court in deciding PC35. If it was not the fact that my day job required input into the PDP, a number of landowners who were affected by Notified Rule 7411 would miss the fact that their development rights and property values were being considerably reduced by a mistake in the PDP, which has no real justification. Was contrary to the long and lengthy PC35 process that has ultimately been accepted by all parties, QAC and residents, and the Environment Court. In my view, Barnes needs to accept that the operative residential density within the e-noise boundary, OCB, is working out via PC35. The outcome may not be perfect for all parties involved, but the end result is that the airport will expand out to 2037, and a limited number of landowners within the e-noise boundary, OCB, might develop in accordance with their long-term development rights for their respective properties. In conclusion, I respectfully request that the Commissioners disallow Notified Rule 7411 and reconfirm that the development rights for such properties for that of one residential dwelling per 450 as per the operative district plan. In this regard, I support the conclusions and findings in this lead in the Section 42 report as for the enormous boundary. There's three more points of discussion could be raised following discussion this morning. Mr. Morgan stated that there were 18 sections within the noise boundary that could be developed two times. By my calculation, there are 16 sections that are over 900 net, which could have two dwellings. The QAC owns four of those properties, and I find it quite ironic that the QAC seeks to undertake large-scale development of its properties. So the end result is there are 12 sections left that could have two dwellings. The reality is not all 12 will be developed, but potentially 12 could. The second issue is about discussion, you know, from the balance in terms of the second residential units, residential flats and so forth. So if I still own my property tomorrow, I could, without resource consent, provide me a bulk location, insulation, ventilation, build an extension that contains 6 bedrooms out the back of 600 square metres, no additional kitchen, it's one dwelling, and I could then put up 20 people as a residential unit. Now, you could say, well, that's fanciful. The reality is there's a house across the road that's doing the same thing. It's a boarding house with 18 people. The garage, mind you, has been converted to 4 bedrooms. But without requiring consent, these properties could be expanded, more people could be involved than a single dwelling or a separate dwelling or a residential flat. And the last issue is obviously, you know, quite clearly in terms of land value. Land are obviously advocating that effective land owners should lose development opportunities, possible and right, for the greater good of the Queensland Airport. The reality is a 300 square metre section at Hamlin Farm is now selling between $250,000 to $300,000 at the moment. Now, despite the fact there's an airport next door to the land of Frankton, a section that's 400 to 500 square metres is probably around the $300,000 mark. So, for the greater good, there are 12 landowners that financially will be taking on, you know, they bought the property to do this, and I bought the property in mind that I could do that. Lose development rights, lose value of the properties for the greater good, considering this whole process was debated in 2008 through PCP 5. In my view, it is quite unjust. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Freeman. Just a few. You'll appreciate I've got headaches about all these issues now over the last few days. 7411, if it wasn't a mistake, nonetheless it's there, it was notified. Another option is the council, if it admits it was a mistake, could just withdraw the rule, and that might take some stress away. Have you approached the council and asked it if it would correct its mistake by withdrawing the offending rule?
That was one of the options that I put forward. It was kept in from memory. So,
okay.
That was one of the options. The, let's just say once I found out about that rule, there was discussions with council. There were discussions with the QAC, and let's just say it took some higher involvement to get the QAC to come to the current stance. So I can't, you know, control Barnes, but we tried, and it's between the process. So the reality now is that there are 12 landowners that, let's say, the commission agrees with them, then 7411. There could be an appeal. If you're a landowner, you're going to be forced into appealing. It's not $10,000, it's a lot of money, so, yeah.
Sure. Under the operative plan, you talked about the permitted operations and extensions, expedients, and stuff like that. What's the status of a residential flat in the current plan?
If we're looking straight by density, high density, permitted activity, so I could ignore the noise boundary, I could have, any dwelling could have a residential flat that meets the definition as a right.
And would that include the site you formerly owned?
Yes, it would.
And as you understand the proposed plan, you, what's your understanding of the issue of a house and a residential flat?
The definition of residential flat at the moment is based on, it's within the main dwelling, is based on the gross 4%, I think it's 35%, and it's in the garage, maybe 50%. The PDP is seeking to liberalise that a touch, and I think from memory it's you can be 70 square metres and it could be standalone as well. So the PDP is seeking to make it a touch easier.
I was, to be candid, a bit surprised that the experts for both QAC and Barnes didn't seem to be aware that there was a residential flat provision under both plans that effectively doubled the number of households that could establish. Do you think those provisions under both plans are actually clear and relatively obvious?
Yes. It's, I would say, ignoring this issue at the moment, over the last year, it's one of the more popular inquiries apart from hotels. There's someone's got a house, and when people are buying 80,000 and turn or converting garages into flats earning $300 a week, the temptation to get a legalised flat for the kitchen is a good income earner, depending on 38 years. So basically, yes, it should be common.
Yeah. Okay, and my last question is I guess what would come closer to the taxi question. Why stop at 450? Why not seek the gentle 300 square metre density?
I'll be honest, I've been in discussion and debate with the QAC for about 7-8 years. And it's pretty hard. So if I go back to the council, in discussions with former council planners, they were looking at high density and the location. And I, first thing I said to them was, well, you spoke to the QAC. I mean, no, I said, well, I think you probably should. In my view, I stuck with the 450, because I just didn't want to fight. If you're looking at a get a holistic point of view. Last night sat down for an hour and a half, 58 minutes, listened to the recording yesterday. The discussion was pretty exciting. Mr. Cole and Ms. Bolden and so forth. And the discussion of, well, my section is 1,000 square metres. It's a 60s house that's 100 square metres. There's 900 square metres of the property that's outside. You're standing in the Kiwi backyard. If you look at having a higher density, you've got more solid walls, you've got less outdoor area, potentially that is better, having the bigger backyards. So I think there is argument for a higher density. Personally, I didn't want to get into the debate.
But to synthesise that, putting aside your own position of pragmatism, understand that if we were ruthlessly applying the legal requirement of most appropriate, is it 300 in that area or the 450?
In terms of the one at least, that's 1 for 300?
Yep.
I would say, if you look at the ventilation issue, you can deal with, and that cost will sit with the landowner, if they're redeveloping. So that's not an airport cost, it's not an operator's cost, that sort of thing. If you've got the covenants that state you can't object, and I've been involved in drafting those, and so that's another thing. The third question is if someone wants to develop an allocation, you'd have to be, if I could be quite frank, and actually must not know the plane flyover. So the question is, if someone wants to develop and they would leave those other controls in place, then I think it's a good idea. Pack and stay are advertised for 180 staff, so wouldn't it make sense to have workers and so forth in Frankton piping work as opposed to getting in the cars and driving? So it does make sense in that location. I do understand the airport in terms of the reverse sensitivity complaints. Having been on the airport liaison committee, there's been, to my knowledge, only two complaints about commercial jets. One was a very low flight. 95% of the complaints are helicopters. The QAC is trying to rectify that in terms of behaviour. So, yeah.
You mentioned you've been involved in drafting some of those no complaints covenants. We've heard from funds and QAC that they're not very reliable for a number of reasons. Can you share that with you?
The covenant, if I understood it, was, well, kept my property, did the retro works on it. The covenant stated that I can make complaints against the airport, but I have to go through the noise management process so I can make complaints to say that helicopter operator is flying too low. The next part of that is I have not been part of any proceedings, legal proceedings through district plan, enforcement action. I can't be involved in any of that. Yeah, in my view, if that is there, then I don't think you can do it. That's there.
Okay. Understanding Ms. Walt's extensive submissions yesterday saying they were worthless.
Well, why have the QOC got non-objection covenants on every section of Jack's Point? And so the question is, the QOC tried to get non-objection, as you probably know, I know, for PC19 on land outside of the out of control boundary. So what's the point of having an OCV if you're trying to go outside of it? So if the covenants are there, and the part I my involvement in the covenant was to state that the landowner can't take proceedings whilst the QAC is operating in accordance with the designation. So which means, in my view, even if the covenant's not there, I can't complain if you're operating in accordance with the planning permission. If the QAC comes back in 5 years' time and goes, hey, we want to fly until 12 a.m. at night, well, came on, they've got to go through the process again. So in my view, it's that, and also on the limbs advising that this is what it is. Just like if I buy a property in Gibson, there are rules on the limb saying, by the way, the reverse hearing devices that could go off at 3 in the morning, or helicopters could come in at 3 in the morning as well.
Thanks for that. There's nothing else, please.
Thank you. I suppose it is just check. You said there were 16 sections owned by number and 4 owned by QAC.
Yes, the QAC have got the 42 in the last 8 months. I can provide you a map as to where those sections are.
Well, in fact, they lodged a plan there evidence for the designation stream which shows those. I was just checking the number.
Yeah, I think I had quickly a look at Mr. Morgan's 18, and I'm not sure where he got to 18, I looked at 16. Because the North Boundary doesn't actually include all of between Ross Street and the Southern State Highway, so I had 18, but mainly over the QAC 8
4. Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you.
My name is Ernest Spikerbock, I'm a long-term resident, business person, I'm a part of council for 4 or 5 years, sitting in the chairs you're sitting in, so my sympathies. I've put in a submission. I don't intend to talk about clause this or that. I'd just like to put a little bit of the human side to the discussions that you're having, particularly around the intensification of the high density, medium and low density areas, because there are a lot of people who've lived here for a long time who have created Queenstown as to what it is, and I think some of them are going to get a little bit overlooked as this goes on. One of the things that it drove me to think about was the planning and the layout of Queenstown as it stands today, which as I understand it was done on a flat table in England, irrespective of the fact that we're an Alpine village. And I think that quite a little bit of what's gone into this intensification is too prescriptive, and it's not taking giving credence to the slopes and the quirks of the landscape. And I'm hoping that in my submission to you there was a coloured photograph that you're able to perhaps look at. And in particular, it's taken out of my front lounge window.
Not the one of China.
Sorry? Not the one of China, no.
Two. Right. We've got two photos of yours.
The one with some red bushes above a sluice pipe.
I don't have that one attached to the submission.
Unfortunately. Okay. Taken out of my front room lounge, and my particular point is that if my house was 1 metre closer to the boundary, under the proposed changes, my windowsill would have to be at 1.2. Now, I'm not much more than that. I wouldn't be able to see out my window, and I have a stupendous view right across the town and the bay and the mountains and everything else. This, I think, will happen in quite a lot of places, because there are slopes and variations in our landscape here, but these rules are very, very prescriptive, and I'm concerned about that, combined with the fact that if the plan was to go through the way it is, the affected neighbours aren't even going to get consulted. And there's the possibility here for people's land values to go down enormously. There's a loss of amenity, there's a loss of dews, and the loss of sunlight, and I'm concerned about that. I'm also concerned that the requirement, quite prescriptive requirements for rubbish, a 240 litre and a 120 litre really bin.
I've already made the point that you don't require that in Wanaka.
You don't need it anywhere. It only encourages you to have rubbish because you've got somewhere to put it. And if you've got 10 or 12 units, you don't need that many really bins. You have one skip.
We are alive.
You are aware of that. That's very good. you know, I fully understand the need for the intensification of the housing, but I think that there needs to be a little more flexibility and a little more of a case-by-case option there. I know that once it goes, once it's through and it's operative, it's a matter of staff ticking boxes, and we need that flexibility for the humanity to be involved as well, and for the charm and the character of our mountain village. Because if we become looking like those pictures in China, the charm of Queenstown is gone, particularly by daytime. Hidden at night, the people who come here for the night scene aren't too concerned about the day scene, but the day scene people are the most important ones. They need to be able to have a good end result. And I just think that the ambience must be protected. We travel and we come back again, travel to China, come back. Thank goodness we live in New Zealand and we live somewhere where things are protected.
We had a submitted earlier today who suggested quite strongly that standards, or if you like, discretion or descriptive discretion, could be loosened up a little bit to encourage a little bit more freedom for people who want to design things that may be perhaps different. Is that how you see things?
I think this is stifling innovation. There are ways that these things can be done, but once you get into too many rules and regulations, there's no room to think outside the box. And yes, I do think that a loosening up and allowing some innovation and maybe, lower here and higher there, if that suits the view of the people behind. But if you've got a blanket, you can't do that the same.
I won't move on to who then makes the decisions about what is innovative and progressive or needed
Very subjective, very subjective. But if the innovation allows some compassion for the neighbours as you're developing, and some reconciliation amongst the neighbours who are suddenly getting something built in front of them, that they still have a reasonable view corridor or reasonable sunshine, then it's worth it.
I would like to introduce another woman in architecture. We are a group, or we represent a group of 18 local architects, so it's not just us four, it's actually 18 of us, and we could have all submitted individually, but we've chosen to submit all together. So we would like you to keep this in mind when you review our submissions against others, because we actually are like a much bigger group, and we actually have no financial motive in comparison to most of the others. We only really promote quality design as our main focus, and this is Sean and Julian and Erin, who are going to introduce the other superintendents.
Could you just wait a moment and get the material set for us, please? There's no need to rush. You can just
I haven't printed my bit off.
Oh, I see.
I'm just giving the preamble to what the detail is.
Right. Okay.
the main point we would like to make is that the plan does not currently create a pathway for outcomes that we believe will be positive, strong and of quality. The plan, as it is currently written, is more likely to leave a low quality built environment for Queenstown. So we want to ask, is this really what you want to achieve, and is that something that you would all be proud of? This plan has been designed to promote densification, which we as a group support. The potential problem with densification is that there is a very real risk that it can be done badly. When building is done quickly, cheaply and in a compact environment with little policing of the design quality, the outcome is likely to be a serious concern. This plan has been designed to promote quick and affordable solutions. We agree that these are some of the considerations that should be addressed. Affordability, however, is not the only criteria for success. The only mechanism that can safely ensure a standard of quality for our built environment is the urban design panel. Any mention of this has been left out of this plan. The reporting officer in the summary of evidence has clearly stated that she believes the urban design panel should occur on a non-mandatory basis. She believes the recommended provisions will support good design outcomes. As a group of architects who work with the district plan and other rules and guidelines on a daily basis, we can assure you that we all believe she is very mistaken in her view. This plan is completely open to some very poor outcomes, which any developer looking to make a quick buck can take advantage of. The reporting officer has also stated that Giles Falconer supports this view. This is completely different to what he has said in his report of the 7th of October, paragraph 4, where he says the high-density residential zone requires sensitive design consideration, and I further recommend specific design guidelines and the use of the UDP. Town planning and architecture are two very different things. A person seeking to address a design by working to the rules is creating a building by saying, is this black or is this white? Good design comes from a great deal of thought, discussion and reference context. Queenstown has a huge variety of styles, topography and context. It would be impossible to address all of these different criteria with a set of rules in the district plan and ensure a quality outcome for all. We are very lucky to have an enormous number of experienced and knowledgeable architects and designers in our community. Let us use this resource as the correct expertise for this job. The UDP is not a difficult mechanism. It can, in fact, be seen by designers and architects as a useful tool and added benefit to the design process. This dialogue will promote the quality of the built environment for future generations, which should be decided by experts in this field. If you take nothing else away from our submission today, realise the value and benefit of a mandatory use of the urban design panel for all of the high-density residential zones and for the medium-density residential zones over 4 units. We will then feel confident that you are leaving a legacy for future generations which is protected. This region grew up on the back of the gold rush. We are now arguably in the midst of a second gold rush. Let us not perpetuate the reputation of a gold rush legacy where buildings are put up quickly and cheaply and substandard architecture is created. Both high and medium density by their nature is inherently more affordable as a form of construction. There is no requirement to cheapen this further by compromising quality. The buildings that will be created as a result of this plan will be here in Queenstown long after all of us have gone. Let your legacy be something we can all be proud of and not an exercise in what not to do.
We're going to talk through the low, medium and high density policies and rules and just some of the points that we feel could be tweaked. So, just by way of my introduction, we all submitted to the Urban Development and Strategic Chapter, But there were 5 points that we felt very strongly about, and one was we want to promote quality in all areas. We wish the urban growth boundaries were recognised and supported, and Frankston very much is an area that has not been master planned, particularly in the context of the airport, and we feel it's not being managed very well in this respect. All the opportunities are not being found, or all the connectivity is not being made, and it's an area that's under flux but is open for development, and the opportunity to plan that is now. We also feel that the lack of a transport section is a bit of a problem, because how are we going to connect everything? And we want rural areas to stay rural. So the main issues we wish to speak to in regards to low density chapter are, one, the retention of outdoor living courts, and we're talking about infilling here with up to 3 houses on the site, and yet we're not actually requiring any outdoor living bar the normal size that we are in front yards, and we actually feel that's open for abuse. A lot of those areas could be driveways or vehicle articulation to get to the rear lot. So we feel that, we strongly feel that in the low density area there must be some provision for outdoor living sizes. We support the new rules about the articulation between the, any new site on the new housing on the site. We're a bit unclear as to how these are going to be put into effect, and we all came up with different views of what they meant. And this is why there's no guideline as to visually how we are going to implement these rules. So if we can't agree on them, how are we going to implement them? We came up with different scenarios between the 2 or 5 and 1.5, 1.5, and we couldn't work it out. So I suggest that needs further thought or reference to residential design guidelines. What about the conversation? That would help. We don't like the word avoidance of flat roofs in Arrowtown, because avoid is a very strong word. We don't think that will need if you have residential design guidelines, very strong guidelines in Arrowtown. If you avoid flat roofs, that means you've got little windows, you might have a flat veranda, and probably can't do that. You've got to avoid it. That's a very strong word. We believe the ability to subdivide inside the noise boundaries controlled by the airport should be retained. I mean, you're taking away people's development rights, but also it's a stupid thing, because to maintain that low density environment around the airport, is that a good thing? Because in fact, medium density is a far better manager of noise than lots of dispersed low density houses with their windows closed. You've got party walls, you've got insulation, all those sorts of things that come at medium or high density, where you've just got individual houses with low density. Continuous building net, we agree to the amendment, and we just say we'd like to have some extra diagrams. So if you go to the rules here, we just made a suggestion that we keep in the encourage the initiative to reduce water demand. I mean, it's only encouraging. I think we should be thinking about these issues. We propose delete the reference to flat roof avoidance. We propose delete the airport reference to prevention of subdivision. We propose that you add in a minimum provision for outdoor living space, which is as per the existing plan. 7.5.3, we would like an interpretive diagram. I mean, we haven't got any residential guidelines that don't need to be in train, so we can make reference to them, but we haven't got any. So it needs to be cleared up at some point. And then this is the thread that runs through all our submissions. We feel that there has not been enough reference to mechanical ventilation, heat pumps, screening around, and all those things. We just feel something should be inserted about service yards, about screening, heat pumps, gas bottles, and everything. So that's within the side yards, so they don't come across to the neighbour next door. We've got to avoid the heat pumps just on their boundary. Like that. I don't have to do that. Right, and now Karen's going to talk to using Sorry, do you have any questions on
I was thinking it might be easier if we hear all of you.
Okay.
You know, yes. ask questions of the whole interview and answer.
Yes.
It's probably easier.
Just in the medium density proposed policies and rules. So currently medium density covers small areas of Aspen Grove, Park Street, Wanaka and Arrowtown. We feel strongly that there are also areas in Brixton that could support successful medium density development. We understand the airport's concerns in regards to noise mitigation, but we feel denser housing topology could mitigate some of these issues inherently.
I presume you'll return in the mapping section.
We have put a map in. I mean, we'll get another turn.
Yes, when we're dealing with actually.
I'm afraid our point is more that it's all very well to have that. It actually needs a master plan exercise. Where is the heart centre and the connectivities? Mm. And it's actually a much bigger issue than just putting a zone over an area.
It could be overlaid with transport, which has not been considered at this time, so that needs a really cohesive overhaul of that entire area.
So our
first main point is high quality development is demanded. It is almost more important in these higher density housing topologies that quality is defined as achieved for increasing the degree of public acceptance of medium density housing. A failure in achieving core defined principles of denser housing topologies has arguably more of a detrimental effect than lower density development. The most successful medium density developments take detailed account of all design issues, including the intended residential mix, neighbourhood character, interface with the public domain, site-specific topography, car parking appearance, style, privacy, security, landscaping, low maintenance and refuse collection. How is this quality assessed? There's quite a lack of assessment rules in terms of quality. Each development needs to be specific to its local context and therefore each response will be unique. We believe the only way to assess good design is through an urban design panel review. Second point is privacy between neighbouring properties. Density and privacy are interdependent and that achieving acceptable standards of privacy is a key issue in the design of socially successful higher density housing. And housing of a medium density to a more stories overlooking of the private open space of adjacent dwellings from upper level roofs represents one of the most common privacy problems. Better rules and assessment for privacy is required. Currently, so under 8.5.10 there was quite a prescriptive rule in regards to windowsill height in the medium density previously, and that was removed, but we suggest that more of a broader rule is added into that. So privacy between neighbours, all windows overlooking the private open space, the main living areas of adjacent dwellings from upper level rooms are screened by either raising sill height, solid illustrating, translucent glazing, on-site landscaping, or other methods illustrated for modelling. So each scheme, you know, should demonstrate a through a section as part of its resource consent. I guess that leads on to point three. Currently, three units are submitted, and there are no assessment matters in regards to privacy or quality. So we are a bit concerned that there are still no rules around privacy or quality for developments of three residential units or less. At least we request building under three units is moved from permitted to restricted discretionary, with similar assessment matters as the developments of residential units over four. So we're a little bit concerned will developers apply for consent and lots of three residential units to escape assessment. And then we believe urban design panel review should be mandatory for developments of four or more units.
And move to a discretionary, fully discretionary.
Yeah. Point four, residential design guidelines should be produced before the site is ratified. Sort of there's a complete lack of understanding of what what this is on your media sensation look like. And that proposed point out under 8.2.3, and throughout the sort of plan there is a lot of reference to and the plan to enhancing a particular character of Arrowtown and Wanaka, but fail to be visionary on how we want Queenstown and Frankston's built environment to develop. The plan should promote a unique Queenstown Frankston built environment which complements our understanding natural landscape and enriches the Queenstown experience for locals and visitors. So I feel like there's a lot of voice at, both in the public as well as in the plan for Arrowtown, but they've got character that they can work off, but there's a complete lack of it in Queenstown and Frankston, and it's just opening us up for perhaps.
Well, that's a recognition of character. But I think we lack character, so I think it's lack of rules that we call, you know, recognition or ideas.
Yeah, it's not just enhancing, it's creating. So it's not just maintaining the status quo, it's
vision. I think the vision being.
Yeah. Number five, continuous building money. We feel that 15 metres should be retained, and if you want to go on within that, you can prove that through reduced building dominance by various means, such as facade circulation. We feel more interpretive diagrams need to be added into the rule section in relation to that, and particularly in reference to medium density of 15 metres, refer to side yards probably, where the back and front elevations of medium density development more typically are more successful if they're broken down into individual units or sort of individual properties. So there's a bad picture of double home which we feel is successful medium density development currently in Brighton. Point 7, minimum lot size. We agree with the government on the rationale for reduced lot sizes, but we feel the larger lot size would be a trigger point for design review. Should sort of smaller lot sizes be sought. And when eight building heights, currently anything over 8 metres is non-compliant, and we feel that if there was an urban design panel review in place, we would support that being a discretionary rather than a non-compliant aspect. Point 9 is refuse yards. Currently, it talks about refuse, but it should be expanded to provision for designated closed drying areas, pumps, gas bottle storage, and inadequate provision and utilisation of these is one of the main reasons negative perceptions are created over the sense of housing topology. So, and also acoustic screening for heat pumps, not just visuals. And finally, outdoor space. We propose a mixed rule as for our high-end submission. Some provision for outdoor space should be in the same.
Right, I'm going to do the high density. Our concern, we believe achieving high quality urban design outcomes through the urban design panel, the production of design guidelines or 3D modelling of high density areas is essential. And the 3D modelling is pre-programmed now, it's not simple like it used to be 10 years ago. It's not simple to do, and we're not talking about large areas.
So every submission needs to have a 3D model, and if a council can hold this one master plan 3D model, so then it can be really accurately assessed on sunshading and view corridors.
I mean, this is we think there's a lot at stake here. So,
move on from the 1970s district plan approach.
Yes, that's right, the three-dimensional approach. We believe that we should reinstate outdoor living areas, both in terms of private and communal, but we're in a considerable environment, we should be able to reach out and be part of it. And it's all about quality of life. We think we should reduce continuous building length to 24 metres. Again, it's a much lower threshold and trigger for design consideration. We feel there should be more flexibility on lot size and height, provided we get high quality design outcomes. And I think I just called Linda's earlier submission, where she was also talking about flexibility and you know, more free range and openness to design. But with less rules, and really, if you have the urban design panel, you can really do away with many of the rules because it's just actually a more flexible approach. And we've all had experience of it. That was written up in the paper this morning, Michael Wyatt was talking, which was twice in the paper this morning. David Gibbs was talking as well about urban design and Queensland, that threshold. So we're not coming up with anything new, it's just reiterating what's there. So just in terms of the urban design panel, the report lost they had concerns about residential design guidelines, and I guess we share some of those concerns, but they might become too boring and safe. You know, it's just they're very prescriptive and this is what it should look like. That's not what we're asking for. We believe our area deserves better quality and is more precious and design sensitive than any other area in New Zealand. And we want excellent design outcomes. And why should we settle for less? And I note that the proposed Otago Regional Council policy statement says that the quality of our urban environment can affect quality of life and community and viability. We need built environments that relate well to their surroundings. So all these statements reinforce quality urban design, and there's statements in the objectives and policy, but there's nothing that tells us how we're going to achieve it. And I don't think we can make these policies and not say how we're actually going to implement them. Because then we're just at the whim of whoever feels like administrating them. We're at the whim of the council of the time, or the planner of the time, but you could be batting against the top wall. You don't know quite what the frame does. So trying to pick out the appropriate words or picking up rules does not promote holistic quality of design. And we also believe that the 3D model would help them. Again, we feel outdoor living needs to be reinstated, and particularly with high density, you're going to get consideration maybe of the top floor of the building, and it should be more than just mechanical ventilation outlets. You know, it can be used, and people have not been raised in some of our buildings. Here, they utilise the top floor, but people won't be pushed to do it unless there's a requirement somewhere for an outdoor space, and they'll start to think more innovatively about how they might provide that. So we've proposed a hybrid law where there's some a per square metre space per unit and a percentage of communal space, but we're saying that can be interchangeable. So maybe you could provide some units with no balcony, but it's compensated by extra communal space on the top or something. But flexibility is what we're after, just so long as some of these spaces are provided most of the time. Not every unit needs a balcony, but most of the time, and it could be compensated another way. That's our solution anyway. Again, we would like to reduce the building length to 24, and so we've gone to multiples of 15 and 24, and that sort of in recognition of what Garth Felton has said about unit size being 8 metres and what we felt that's quite appropriate. Again, the 24 is the threshold for would hopefully trigger more intensive design review. And we would like more flexibility in terms of height and all these sort of things, provided that good quality outcomes are achieved. And so just the points in our submission that we really want to talk to on the provisions here, 9.4.4, all residential units in the high-density zone shall be assessed by the Earth Design Panel by the principles of context, character, choice, connection, creativity, custodian, and collaboration. And the activity needs to be fully discretionary. And again, we want to add an assessment matter shall be assessed by the Earth Design Panel. We want to add in a requirement for outdoor living space. We want to reduce the length of the continuous building length. Again, we want consideration of what happens in the service yard, mechanical services and things like that to be addressed. And we actually have no definition of what quality urban design is. So I've suggested one, which is to the principles of the 7 C's. Now, the last point that I just want to talk about, and I don't know if it covers everything, but they have made an amendment to the ground slope rule, which we don't believe will work, and we would like the retainment of the existing ground level. That area you can explain is much better why we don't want it.
So if you've got a sleeping site, I think the current rule is if you've got a sleeping site on any elevation of the building, it is assessed as being a sleeping site, because currently it's of, I think the rule's changed to basically any elevation or all elevations, but on a sleeping site, the front elevation is effectively parallel where side elevations on a sleeping site. So
So you've got a sign like this, and we'd look at it and say, well, that's total height of one section, because that's more than 1 in 7, probably than or 1 in 6. So that means we can put the 7 metre building. But under the new one, if one of us says you can't, if one of us level, then you can't apply, we don't know where you apply. So maybe for a little bit and then for another bit. I mean, it becomes really difficult to.
It just doesn't make sense that they've changed the way it's written. It made sense before and now it doesn't make sense.
And,
there was one point, sorry, I forgot on the meeting, the 8.4.22. In the meeting, you see, one of the separate sort of assessment matters added, and we feel that some of those are quite relevant and should be applied to all medium density zones, not just
one. Why is that overlay fine? I mean, they've all got assessment matters,
yeah.
Why don't other areas get the same consideration? That vertical versus horizontal.
Well, I've got some questions of clarification, thanks. You made, and I'll refer to all of you, you made reference to guidelines in their words. We may not be talking about the same thing, so I just want to be clear that we are. Are you talking about a guideline which gives a whole bunch of ideas that are not binding, or are you talking about a code that sets out requirements to be met?
It depends on if the urban spine tower, we feel more strongly that the urban spine tower should be implemented, and then it also good to have an urban spine guideline to encourage diversification of thought, because a set of rules just encourage maybe people just to comply with the rule, but the guidelines could be a document with a whole lot of diagrams and reference images.
So the guideline is effectively a bunch of good ideas to think about.
It's a bit of both though, like if you look at the guideline for continuous building then, it only looks at a ground floor plan and it shows you how it goes in and out. Now it doesn't actually tell you how that translates over one or two stories. Like it's not a three-dimensional, and yet we've argued, on the second floor high gibbet, or if that's vertical, or if that index meter continues three floors, or...
Well, that might just be a function of the diagrams not good enough, but what I want to understand is if I don't meet the diagrams, so what?
Well, if it's a good design, and it doesn't meet the guidelines, but there's an urban design review that goes, well, that's a good design. So a good design might break all the rules, but comply with all the objectives of what we're trying to achieve here. And that's why the only way is having an urban design review with design professionals that can assess the scheme in a particular context. So every context is uniquely different.
Yeah, so you sort of answered the next question I was going to ask, which is whether you're asking that every application beyond a certain threshold has to have an urban design panel review, which is what you said, or whether you're actually saying they need to be approved by the urban design panel, which is what I think you mean.
No, we're not asking, I don't think you have to be approved, because it's all other things that come into play. I'm just saying that it's a mechanism for
the
mechanism of better design. It's not designed by a committee,
yeah,
or the urban design panel.
You could argue the urban design panel, the committee too, I suppose. So, thank you for that. So let's say I come along, I acquire a site or whatever, I come and propose a daring design, like the one I keep looking at out the window next to ICARS. I rock along to the panel. The panel says we hate it. It's the worst thing we've ever seen. It failed the guideline.
Some of the other things that design review, and we could have done a 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 design review,
in a panel.
Yes.
An application might still get granted consents on the basis of all those other things you talked about.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, I mean, unless past flexibility, you're going to get, but at least you're going to get a variety of builder rather than they just, you know, our concern if it's only residential guidelines descriptive, you'll just get that sort of thing.
No, right, that's what I'm saying, so in terms of the design panel, I don't want to say being supersized because it's not growing, but maybe being used a bit more. Does that create, in your view, any capacity issues in terms of those four people that now have to work on the treadmill 60 hours a week, those four panellists overwhelmed with, does that mean the panel has to grow much bigger? Does that mean the panel starts maybe losing its consistency?
Well,
I don't know, I probably take more limitations than they probably do the reviews and that way, you know, I mean some judgment, I think exercise, okay, yeah, no, so that's a different role, so I think they have a solution. There's another question about whether a trilogy be called an urban design panel if it's actually a design panel if it more broadly sense, but that's probably a matter for the council to think about outside of this. What I wanted to ask though was, we have had other submitters raise concerns with the urban design panel, whether it's based on experience they've had or not, we don't know, but they've talked about the need for more transparent processes of conflict of interest, of panellists stepping down, of the panel, if it's to have more of a role in the regulatory process, maybe becoming a bit more regulated, if you follow that train of thought. Do you have any sense on issues of, in a town like Queenstown, how you manage things like conflicts of interest with the panel?
I reckon if there are general design guidelines which everyone can relate to, like quality outdoor living and like in some like variations on the facade, if that is all kind of set or in the guidelines and what we're kind of asking for, then the urban design panel is only really a tool for the planner to have actually the experts who are the designers basically explain or like maybe like implement a bit further like something which could benefit more people rather than being only focused on the developer who would like to go as cheap as possible potentially. I reckon it will still need a broader
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
But it's not about creating all buildings to be strawberry flavoured, it's about how does that building affect its neighbours, its amenity to the streets, all of those things, and if you submit the 3D model, it can be more accurately assessed than the urban grindhill concern around and actually have the knowledge to actually be able to assess those matters, because as architects, you do that all the time when you're designing your own buildings. So,
I think that our major fear in moving all of this, all the way through that kept coming up, is that the way that it's currently written is that it is really exposed and at risk to things being done very quickly and cheaply and just getting through. And it's a combination of all these things. We're highlighting the fact that we think that the urban design panel, it does have its limitations, but we don't see any other mechanism that can strongly create a future that we can feel safe, that it is going to be a good future for the Queenstown development, because this is a major plan change that we're going through, and it's going to have a huge effect on the quality of this environment that we're talking about. So this is a really big point in time where we have to significantly influence what's in this plan, and at the moment, it's not written in a way that we feel that our built environment is going to be safely protected. protected. So it's a combination of all these things. We say the urban design panel is weak and is the only way that we can have the assurance that we've got a quality built future. But that comes at the same time of having these tools such as the 3D modelling, which is not a difficult thing to do, but there's actually no reason not to do it. But also properly explained diagrams and guidelines so that people have got something to follow, because the urban design panel is something that you reach at a certain point in time, and not everybody who attacks a design necessarily has the same level of experience. And not even just that, like if you're in a situation as an architect and you've got a developer who's pushing you very strongly to do something very cheaply and as, you know, cost effectively as possible, if you've got a policing mechanism which is not just you saying, let's think about this a little bit more cleverly, let's try and achieve a better outcome, if you say, well actually we're going through an urban design panel process and this won't be good enough, then you've got another backstop. So there's lots of ways that the current plan is at risk of the dominance of poorly designed buildings in Queenstown. And that's something that we're very aware is likely to happen any day.
I think what's happening actually at Queenstown is a fairly successful model. They've got guidelines and they've got a design review panel. It comes up under a lot of criticism, obviously. Because everyone doesn't want to be rejected, I guess, but there are design outcomes out there that have broken all the rules but have complied with the objectives. But it's just a lot of the negative aspects of those guidelines that people think that's what they have to produce, and so they just produce a lot of the same. But
so in fact, people move really quickly.
Yeah,
and it's just like that. Like,
yeah.
First 2 or 3 years of huge backlashing.
Yeah.
And now it's like, just be like, okay, we've got to do it well. And
it protects their
Okay. You left the question behind a few months ago, but that's okay. I have just one more question. We spoke to Mr. Feltner on behalf of the council. And we asked him to give us some clearer advice on guidelines and where the plans are and what's needed. And he told us that while they would be extremely valuable to have, they weren't must-haves that the plan couldn't survive without. They could be added later, as distinct from saying they had to be there from day one and the plan couldn't proceed without them. You've indicated that the guidelines are incredibly important and need to be there from day one, but just so you know what it's about to say.
Big
stage
that, like everything's on the move at the moment. If we don't set the bar high, we're simply going to slip back very quickly.
Alright, understood. Thank you for that.
Can I just ask, I don't understand how this works, like what do you guys do?
Good question.
Are you the decision makers?
The council's the decision makers, but the council agree with our recommendations
right. Without
rehearing them all. So
what we write here, because you obviously listen to what we say here, but when you go away from this, do you look at what we've written in more detail than perhaps what we've said here?
Both what you've said and what you've written.
Right.
And
I'm just a bit worried that we haven't been
100%
clear. So I hope you listen.
We have recordings of it.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Any questions? No, just the issue that probably the industry came around with this is spider wash. Looking for more freedom.
We are also talking about more flexibility. And
flexibility.
The same thing that she was saying, more interesting architecture, more
that. I've got one question further. So you were saying then that in the plan we have got something that is permitted, perhaps it should be discretionary, so
and the non-compliant, for example, height, but actually that's moved to discretionary because we think, you know, there's often opportunities you might be able to use the hill or whatever where you can actually see height without affecting people, so long as it's being considered in terms of your neighbours or what other areas of context that you're in.
And that it should be assessed by a design professional, not just a planner, so it's not just about compliance with rules, it's about...
I understand that, but just overall concept.
Yes, so what I didn't hear what Una was saying is any different to what we're saying. It's just the mechanism by which you reach there. And we're saying actually the urban design panel review, it's not an onerous review and it's not the last word. I mean, it is, it's another layer, but you know, if it works well, they can override some of that compliance rules through the recommendations they might make.
If you produce a good design, it should just be a simple, well, that was awesome, get on with it.
You've covered all the things that we need to know. Thank you. And Ms. McCarthy, can you ask for twice as much time, please, as you think?
Oh, yes. Well, sorry, when I do...
You did it the first time as well. You would get
yes,
twice
so
as
much. Yes, so I've got my lovely colleagues on board, and we went into it a lot more depth than we intended, but...
Well, let's do that at mine. Just prefer if you ask for an hour.
Yes.
And you'll, I know that you'll fill up.
Yes.
So if I ask questions.
Thank you.
Do you want a copy of this that I wrote, or is that
yes,
not
going to be?
We've only got one.
It'll go up on the
I can drop off some more.
Yeah, thanks. Do I need to drop
off
the camera? No, I'll
just copy it. Yeah. Ms. Hill,
can
you just... Sorry, we've got someone else who's on the floor. Can you? Thank you. Yeah. Oh, and we've got some next. Like, can we have a go at another minute?
Yes, so we heard this letter before you earlier.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. So I just handed out some brief submissions, and I propose that I take you through these, it shouldn't take too long,
yes.
And then I might refer you to Mr. Cassell to elaborate on a couple of key aspects, if that's okay?
Yes.
Great. So, good afternoon, Smith. These legal submissions are presented on behalf of the clients named on the front page of these submissions. So the Kessels family, the Bulling family, the Bennett family, the Lynches, and the Friends of Oxford Gardens and the Zoo. These submissions to complement two other legal submissions which have been presented in the course of the proposed district plan hearings in topic 01 about strategic direction on urban development and topic 03 heritage. A little bit of background about the case. So the submitted case is focused on protecting the special residential and amenity character of the area bounded by Park Street, Franklin Road and Hobart Street and intersected by Brisbane Street. Here I'm referred to as the special character area in the submission. Although the submissions have been identified as being a rezoned matter appropriate for being transferred to the mapping hearings of the proposed plan, the submitters consider that critical aspects of the case are important to bring to the attention of the Commissioners making recommendations on the wider MUC chapter. The submissions originally sought broad relief ranging between identifying special character overlay, retaining the operative plan provisions and zoning, and providing bespoke planning provisions within the PPP zoning to reflect special character. Consequentially, an alternative relief is also sought in the submission, meaning that many options are available to the grant and the outcome sought. Submitters now wish to clarify that the focus of the case at the mapping hearings next year will be to retain ODP zoning equivalent rather than providing for a bespoke special character overlay. These submissions primarily focus on amendments to the wider NDR chapter should a rezoning of the special character area not be successful. The special character area has important amenity values and exhibits character which warrants the level of recognition and protection beyond that provided through the NDR chapter. The special and distinctive character of the area is driven by the combination of small-scale residential homes that have grown organically since the area was first settled in the 1870s. The area holds a distinctive residential identity that ultimately generates a strong sense of place for many of the residents who live here and call Kent County home. And part of its key distinctiveness and charm is that it is not wholly or obviously homogenous. The important values of the area should be better protected, both at the strategic level by acknowledging it generally of the worth of those values and at the operational level by providing prudential provisions that give appropriate weight to protection of those values and character. The Friends of the Gardens and Reserves is the preeminent community representative group which acts as the voice for the Waterloo Gardens and Reserves areas. The protection of the character of the gardens also requires consideration of protecting the amenities of the immediate surrounding gardens. Quality urban design, built form and residential amenity, as I'm sure are aware, are relevant factors to be provided for parts of the Act. Increased densification of residential zones should not be provided for at the cost of compromising residential amenity. It is vital that unique character neighbourhoods are protected and that increased development is focused only on areas which are capable of absorbing the effects of such development. The residents of the area have crafted a statement of significance for the purposes of working towards planning hearings. Although this statement will likely be subject to further refinement, it is included here to benefit the Commissioner's understanding of the full case. And it is as follows. A precinct of unique character being evocative of the various stages of residential development of the original central Queenstown settlement and town and being contiguous with the Gardens Reserve and the Queenstown Bay, in and deriving much of its character from a location of special value for the CBD and district. And Mr. Kensington can probably elaborate on the statement a bit further, whether you'd like to do that now or at the end of these submissions. Probably up to you. I need to keep going quickly.
Probably easier.
Yes. Yeah. Sure thing. Yes, no problem. So onto the strategic direction of the proposed plan. I won't elaborate on this too much as sort of seen and gone in a sense. But the section largely repeats what has been said in that hearing stream already. I guess the key aspect to focus on is that, you know, there are provisions within the strategic direction chapter which provide for, you know, the core elements of ensuring a quality built environment and taking into account character of individual communities. And that there is goal 3.2.3. The committee considered that goal provides an overarching desired environmental outcome, which is broader than historic heritage. It seeks to achieve an outcome of character and individualism which identifies communities. And I submit that lower order chapters of the PDP, including chapter 8, medium density, should consider how best to get to that goal. So my next section is about the urban design lead approach. The focus predominantly on provisions or concepts of the NDR chapter, which are appropriate to achieve sustainable management and accord with the higher order provision of the PDP. This is an important alternative position for submitters should the rezoning case be unsuccessful. The submitters consider that a number of existing provisions in the proposed plan already provide for this key aspect and are supported to be retained. And I set some of those key provisions out in subparagraph C on page 5, being 8.2.2 objective and associated policies and 8.2.3 objective and policy 8.2.6 relating to the requirements of urban design guides. The submitters consider that those provisions, as amended through the Section 42A report, provide stronger and more appropriate principles to guide design and development. These amendments also accord with Section 7C of the Act, which requires maintenance and enhancement of amenity values. The next paragraph there, subparagraph A, talks briefly about a case which was picked up on in the submissions in the Heritage hearing, and if you would like me to elaborate on that further, I'm happy to, otherwise I would just refer to those urban law submissions. The evidence of Mr. Governor, which suggests stronger use of its design guidelines to assist medium density development, are also supported by the submitters. It is submitted that ensuring development occurs in accordance with best practice guidance will provide an effective mechanism for ensuring amenity values and the quality of the environment are maintained, whilst not providing an overly prescriptive process in the plan itself. This approach, however, is reliant on keeping those principles up to date and, similar to the PDP process, ensuring that they are developed in a manner which reflects the character of individual neighbourhoods and the residents' considerations. If any guideline were to be introduced by council in the future, it is important that it reflects the existing characters and values of different areas of zones. Mr. Falcon McKibben further suggests that another method of achieving design review is to require development proposals to achieve final design panels. He's quite confident that this should be what we expect, so I won't dwell on this, but the submitters agree that such an approach could be useful in principle. However, this approach will not achieve sound-term outcomes where there are no clear and objective guidance criteria in place. Use of an urban design panel should only be in addition to those used with guidelines discussed above, rather than relied on in isolation. Reliance only on an expert panel could otherwise result in ad hoc or inconsistent decision making. And to this end, the submitters consider that policy 8226 be retained is vital, along with associated urban design mechanisms, as identified in the government's evidence. On to my next section 5, about general densification in the medium density zone. I probably don't need to read out the summary statement of the zone purpose, which is copied from the section 42A report. However, I'll talk to it briefly, and that if submitters consider that purpose statement clearly articulates the balance to be achieved between providing an increase in densification while retaining character and community values and the quality of the built environment. That summary assures plan users that development will only be appropriate where the receiving environment is capable of absorbing the effects of such development. Some provisions of the MDR chapter, however, do not appear to match that stated purpose, and that they appear to provide for lack of justification. For example, Objective 821, which reads, medium density development occurs close to town centres, local shopping zones, activity centres, public transport routes and non-vehicular trails. The associated policies for Objective 821 similarly provide for a presumption for densification close to town centres to avoid urban sprawl. It is submitted that those provisions could more helpfully be framed to the cause of those general purpose statements and instead provide further policy guidance as to where densification will or will not be appropriate. And the final section of these submissions is about Homestar rating rule, which has recently proposed to be removed from the plan. If the submitters are unsuccessful in its rezoning hearing and the medium density zoning is retained, a key aspect of that chapter is opposed, and that is the ability to get a bone density allocation if a 6-star Homestar rating is achieved. The submitters consider that it is suitable that the proposed plan encourage appropriate uses of an innovative housing technology to provide for sustainable development. However, it is not appropriate that such provisions provide a bonus system which could otherwise result in breaches to important density restrictions and therefore compromise amenity and quality. Removal of the Homestar tool provisions is therefore supported, as outlined in paragraph 9.34 of the section 42A report.
Thank you,
Thank you. I'll refer to Mr. Kettle to now elaborate on the state of the significance and help us with the next.
Thank you, Commissioner. I don't know if you want me to, I just am prepared to have a go at trying to describe this if you'd like me to. And we have some material prepared for that. For example, I could read a paragraph from a report prepared by Origin Consultants, which will ultimately go into evidence, which was prepared when consideration was being given to special character overlay. The final paragraph reads as follows, and this is a statement of Ms. Andrea Farmer. Overall, the area encompassed by Dyke Street, Brisbane Street, Hobart Street holds a distinctive residential character, built on a surviving historic heritage that ultimately generates a strong sense of place for many of the residents who live there and call Queenstown their home. Well, though known as an international tourist destination and the focus of much recent commercial and investment development, Queenstown increasingly lacks such a sense of place and has struggled to retain its built heritage that is a fundamental part of its historic story. The area of Park Street, Brisbane Street still retains some of that historic built fabric, alongside an even stronger sense of place for its residents and those who pass through. And I'll come back to that if I may. No area can or should remain static, as Park Street has demonstrated itself, but retaining areas with an identifiable character and broad heritage value is essential if Queenstown is to have any story to tell in the future. The reference there to those who pass through prompts me to put a couple of things if I can. One is we declare immediately a high sense of NIMBYism here, and that's because we know the area, and we have clearly a special interest in maintaining its character because we live there. But we would like to stress that a significant part of the emphasis for us participating as we are in this process, and that particularly includes the Friends of the Gardens, is because we have observed that a great many tourists of this area use the area to walk around and have a form of passive recreation that is otherwise not available, and which it seems they seek as part of their holiday experience. So this is not just the residents wishing to keep things as they are, although there's a high element of that, it's because it is part of the Queenstown experience to be able to wander through the gardens and walk around the district and get a sense of what the place is. And that sense is informed by the special proximity of the area to the gardens and the bay and the CBD. In a way, it's quite difficult to describe what it is we seek to protect. It almost like trying to say what it is not. But as we have submitted, it's not homogenous, but it has a special character, and it's one which we believe can be protected without losing, for the district and its residents, the capacity for further housing, if that is the underlying motivation of the proposed plan. The only other thing I'd say in that regard is that in the time that we have been there, which is since 2000, the area has changed gratifyingly by the arrival of young families who wish to live there. And there was a demonstrable sense of community, so that if it is, as we submit, important that there be a sense of community in this part of the district, we believe it would be threatened if the proposed densification occurred. And part of that concern arises from our experience of property speculation that has taken place wherever proposals for increased densification have been put up. The policies, in short, have not often been achieved. It has simply become an opportunity for speculation, and areas have not been developed in a way which advances the whole community. Sorry, it's a bit longer than I expected.
No. I'm fine. It's the third time I've heard you, so.
Yes, I
think.
I could just ask, Joe, how would you envisage the future for that area? I mean, at the moment you've got, you know, relatively very old buildings.
Yeah.
You've got some quite modern, rough cast houses. It's a really fixed, if you like, residential area.
It is. It is.
Yeah. What do you see for further out? Or is you see a danger in what the old college being brought up for there a couple of,
well,
two point five story apartment buildings put there?
Well, we are anxious that this is not entirely just a heritage of maintaining old things, including the building we live in. Clearly there has to be modification and densification to allow people to live there and for families to prosper there. And there will be some things that have happened or have happened that have to be accommodated. You know, there's a there that are going to need apartments of a kind on them. So we'll continue to be a mix. I think the challenge that we're trying to enunciate is to get an increase in residential area of a community nature, but without losing the character. Which is why ultimately it's quite hard to prescribe and rules and why the use of urban design mechanism with guidelines and the appropriately enlightened occupants might work.
Because you've got a couple of quadric sites there now.
Yeah, we do.
Big as well. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, dear. Just the entrance, please. You both are very patient.
Therefore, in my view, the provisions of a roof bonus is a more efficient and effective method that directly encourages opportunities for roof circulation. I don't have time for questions now. I'd like to...
No, if I'm all on top of roof bonuses.
We're about the fourth person we've had in the last 3 days.
All right, thank you. All right.
That was easier than you expected, wasn't it?
Oh, hopefully in a good way.
Similarly, to assist the hearings panel, I've prepared some comments in respect to the summary of evidence prepared by Ms. Gaines, the Identity Residential Zone, on the 7th of October 2016. In particular, I will address her comments in paragraphs 7C, D and K. At paragraph 7C, Ms. Banks suggests that the notified 10 megahertz limit would provide the ability for three-storey development or greater subject to excavation. I acknowledge that this is a possibility, However, excavation can be an expensive component of residential development, particularly on slated sites from the Queenstown Lakes District, and especially if rock isn't counted. Earthworks and construction costs subsequently flow onto the affordability issues of residential accommodation that are presently causing major concern in the district. In this regard, I note that policy 3.2.6.1.2 in the strategic directions chapter of the proposed district plan suggests that in applying plan provisions with respect to minimum allotment sizes, density, building coverage and height, that regard should be had on how these controls influence residential affordability. Accordingly, my recommended rewording of the notified standard 9.5.2 does not disincentivise developers making use of excavation where this is cost effective and or desirable, but enables intensification of the high density residential zone land without significant excavation costs, while still achieving quality urban design outcomes through the restricted discretionary activity status and the specified matters of discretion. At paragraph 70, Ms. Banks suggests that resource consent would be required as a restricted discretionary activity for height limits, presumably meaning the heights between 7 metres and 10 metres, and that minor breaches to the notified height limit that achieve better design outcomes may be considered favourably. With respect, I consider Ms. Banks has misinterpreted my position. I have recommended, on the basis of advice from Mr. Williams, a height limit of 9 metres with a roof bonus of 2 metres, giving a total height of 11 metres as a restricted discretionary activity. If a developer were to go to 11 metres under the notified provisions, even if to achieve roof articulation, this would actually require a non-compliant activity consent pursuant to notified standard 9.5.3, and in my experience would not be an incentive for developers due to the uncertainty of gaining consent. Accordingly, it is my opinion that rewording standard 9.5.2 to allow for a maximum 11 metre height limit as a restricted discretionary activity is still necessary and is appropriate when it is recognised that any height above 9 metres will be the application of the roof bonus and subject to assessment with specific regards to roof articulation, visual interest and amenity values of adjoining properties. At paragraph 8, Ms. Banks suggests an alternative to my reworded standard 9.5.2 being the retention of the notified standard 9.5.2 and adding a new standard for minor breaches for a roof bonus as a fully discretionary activity. In my opinion, this would be a poor planning solution. First, the suggested alternative provides no quantification of what constitutes a minor breach. As such, it would be impossible to advise clients whether a proposal is a discretionary activity or a non-compliant activity pursuant to standard 9.5.3. Council officers would also have difficulty in determining what activity status applies and would need to undertake a subjective case-by-case assessment. In addition, it is my opinion that a restricted discretionary activity status is more appropriate as the specificity of the activity and its potential effects are well known, and the matters of discretion are appropriately directed at addressing these issues. Further, notified rule 9.6.3 also ensures that where adverse effects of additional height on adjoining properties occur and written approval is not obtained, those property owners will have the opportunity to participate in the resource consent process through limited notification. Applying a fully discretionary activity status would therefore not achieve any greater level of assessment and protection of environmental effects from increased height than that proposed in my reworded standard 9.5.2 and notified rule 9.6.3. For the above reasons, I do not consider this to be an efficient and effective planning outcome. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I think as far as discretion goes, with this height stuff, you're heading in that direction as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
No, I have no questions. Your point of evidence was quite clear. Thank you.
Now, I'm doing the call 10 a.m. on the 7th of November.